Hey everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Indie Film Cafe. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I'm here with...
Polly Presenza, otherwise known as the Moo Cow Moo.
And we have...
Joe Turk.
Joe Turk is back this season, so we're really excited to have you back.
And yay!
You know what, Paul? This is the first guy we've had on the show for now.
For this season,
we've had a lot of females and everything, yeah. So we're going to have a couple guys, but we've been doing a lot more...
Fighting the trend, unless we get you gender swapped and turn you into Joette.
Actually, that won't happen. One, and it'd be Joanne if it did, probably.
Oh, he's already got
okay, there you go.
No, because, Joanne's sort of the feminine for... Or Josephine.
Josephine. If you want to get all fancy schmancy. Yeah.
I like...
But Josephine! But I'll
say that there's no chance of that happening. And, not that there's anything wrong with that.
But it's expensive.
It probably is, and that's... Why are we talking about this? This is not... This had nothing to do with the movie I picked, by the way.
I could go a whole different... A whole other direction with that, because it's like... That raises a whole bunch of questions about expensive, and...
I know.
It's like, yeah, but we'll just leave it there.
Let's please leave it. Okay. So, moving on, Yep. I was going to say, as Paul says, moving on. We're going to be talking about the 1985 film that I know Paul has seen, but I'm not sure if you have seen, Thou Shall Not Kill Except.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Does not sound familiar.
Okay, you are in for a treat.
Now, I did see a bunch of stuff in the 80s that I don't recall, that one doesn't ring a bell.
I'm not going to tell you anything about it. You're going to have to go in blind, which will probably make it more exciting.
I can tell you that I don't believe there's any gender-questioning issues in the film.
That's why I said I don't think it has anything to do with this film.
Will I leave the film wanting to go blind?
What?
Will I leave the film after watching the film? Will I wish I was blind?
I don't know.
I don't think it's that kind of movie.
No. It's probably going to get not a low score, but a lower score.
It's a decent movie. Yeah. It's not a great movie, but... It's fun.
It's a fun little action flick. I think you'll like it.
I haven't seen it in a good while.
Yeah. And
20 years at least.
I know. And you're going to see it on Blu-ray.
Nice.
So you'll see it as the best possible way that it can come through Synapse Films put it out.
And nice.
It is one of those films. I know a lot of backstory on it, so I can't wait to discuss it. Mm-hmm. But until then, I'm not even going to tell you guys anything specific until we do the thing while we're watching it, but... it'll be fun to hear what we all have to say, especially considering Joe has not seen it. And I've seen it a million times, and you've said you've seen it a few times.
A million times, wow. Multiple, many times.
Oh, a lot, yeah. Okay. I've seen it a lot.
It's a good movie.
I like it a lot, you know. It's fun. And I've listened to the commentary before. Like, it's just a fun
that
movie.
I've not heard, so I'd be very curious about some of that.
I'll tell you more of who's on the commentary and all that stuff later.
Sweet.
But until then, everybody, we're going to have to listen to some... Mood music, and be right back. And we are back. All right. Woo! Continuity Monkey actually was needed.
Oh, yeah. There were some issues. A few issues.
Continuity Monkey ran to the other room, I
think. Yeah.
He was like, I gotta get away from this movie.
Thou shalt not squeak, except when there's continuity issues.
Yeah, exactly. So the Blu-ray, Paul was wondering before what they have on the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So it's got it's an all-new definition, 2K and digital.
Who put this out? Synapse?
Synapse Films, yeah. 2K digital restoration from the original negative, the original Super 8 millimeter short film Strikers War, starring Bruce Campbell.
Do they have that? Is that on
there?
That's awesome. That's awesome.
We're gonna do that for short film. Yay!
Is the short film like based off of what the movie was based on?
Yeah. I'll get into it in a little bit, but they basically made a pilot, to try to raise investors and
stuff.
Oh, yeah, like okay. a proof of concept.
I've seen that done a lot before.
Yeah.
See, this can be done.
Made in Michigan, the making of Thou Shalt Not Kill Except. Two audio commentaries.
Nice.
One featuring director Josh Becker and co-writer Bruce Campbell and star Brian Schultz. And there was another one with... I guess there was one with Brian Schultz and somebody else. So I'm guessing Bruce Campbell and Josh Becker for one, and then Brian Schultz and somebody else.
I thought you were going to say Sally and Whiskey.
Oh, that would have been nice.
Whiskey Dandy.
I don't think Whiskey was around when they were making this, sadly. No. You know. All
aged
new...
Whiskey.
Aged.
Did age. Okay, wait. All new video interview with Bruce Campbell. Deleted scene. So there was a one deleted scene with optional director's commentary.
You knew there had to be.
There was alternate title sequence and a original theatrical trailer and reversible cover art.
Okie dokie.
Okie dokie.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, so that was...
So no commentary from Raimi, though?
Yeah. No. And I mean, I don't. It's not like he disowns this movie or anything. Like it's just, it's
probably
just
doesn't want people to remember.
No, he just probably was busy. I mean, he's a busy guy. So
I'd be interested to hear what some of his sequences.
Yeah, what's he doing all day long these days? Come on.
If I ever met him again, I did meet him once, but I was so awestruck of being right next to Sam Raimi that I could not say anything but that I was a huge fan of his. And do you know what he said to me? Oh, you're so sweet. And then put his, you know, arm around me, took the picture, and walked me off. You know, and I was like,
"Now go away."
Yeah, now go away.
So he was definitely not in the character that he was in for this.
No, he was a very nice guy.
True.
He was a very nice guy. Yeah. I liked him.
He was the dark man.
But he was the only person I've ever walked, you know, like walked in the huge line and got nervous, you know, because like. You know, I've sat in line for Robert Englund. I've sat in line for all these other people, and I've never felt that feeling. But I was feeling like I was meeting a god to me. It would be like if I met Tarantino, you know.
Or Robert Best, yeah. I totally get that.
Or Dustin Ferguson, you know.
Neil Breen, come on.
Neil Breen, yes. I'd be nervous for another reason.
I'd definitely be nervous.
Everybody has their idols or people that they would be, I'd be nervous for other reasons for some of them.
Yeah, but Sam Raimi, I mean, I just, it's, you know, it's kind of like a god of filmmaking.
For indie filmmaking, definitely.
And I met Ted Raimi that thing, too, and he was super duper nice and just cool dude, but... I love Ted Raimi and I loved him in Lunatics, a Love Story, loved him in this, but I didn't feel the same way meeting him.
Yeah.
But then again, he was right next to one of my biggest crushes, Serena Vincent.
He's kind of the shemp of the group.
That was probably who I was more.
He's the shemp of the group.
All right. Nice. So we are going to be talking about the background of this film and stuff. And so I've got a whole load of stuff, so get ready. So back in the late 70s, 79, I believe, Josh Becker came up with the idea for a Vietnam Marines fighting the Manson family. His idea was that, like, he was trying to figure out a good story, right? Like, what could be something that can be made into a good script? So his idea was, like, back in, you know, Vietnam stuff, right? Okay, the war was going on back in the day. What else was happening in 1969? And then he was thinking, the Manson family. Like, well, who would fight them?
It's a mashup.
Who would fight them? Would it be the cops? Cops would just arrest them. Whatever, right? You know? And probably lose anyway, because, you know, whatever.
Clearly it should have been, you know, ninja penguins fighting the Manson family.
So they ended up going with... he ended up going with the Marines. So the Marines fighting the... We'll get into the Marine stuff later. But it became that, and he pitched it to a little guy, at that time wannabe filmmaker named Sheldon Lettich. Sheldon Lettich was my first interview I did for Indie Film Cafe Spotlight, actually, interestingly enough. And he would later do Rambo 3, and he did... what is it?
Which ripped off this movie.
Yeah, exactly. You would do Rambo 3. You would do, Lionheart and Double Impact. A lot of Jean-Claude, Only the Strong.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
And so he did a lot of really great movies.
Good stuff there.
So they pitched, Josh Becker pitched it to Sheldon, and Sheldon was an ex-Marine, you know, and everything. He must be.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he was actually fought in Vietnam. You know, and stuff. So he pitched the idea to him, and at first they, he was like laughing about it, going, it should be called Bloodbath, you know, right? And then later he called him up and said, no, I like this idea. Like, this isn't a funny, stupid idea. This could actually be done. So they decided to work together, and they wrote a 180-page script.
Wow.
Called Bloodbath. And Josh Becker said it was the most, like, serious, too serious of a film, and he didn't want to make it. You know, he didn't want to make it to, because, so he told them later after, you know, he thought about it and everything, told Sheldon, sorry, I can't do it the way it is right now, whatever. And he was living in LA at the time, and Sheldon was just like, I don't care. Like, I've moved on. He had moved on to, I think he was shooting another movie at that time or whatever. That was a Vietnam movie. So he had actually already, you know, wrote something else. I don't think it was Rambo 3. I don't think he wrote Rambo 3 till like, you know, a few years later or whatever. I think after this movie, so maybe it was. Maybe he took ideas. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I just know, but by Rambo 3, the Vietnam thing was pretty much done.
Yeah. They were just fighting other people, like, you know.
Really, nobody was doing Vietnam stuff after that.
So he ends up going and going back to Michigan to work on Within the Woods and Evil Dead. Within the Woods was like this proof of concept that they did for the Evil Dead. I think that could be found on YouTube, or used to be able to be found on YouTube. Sam Raimi does not like people seeing his older work. I understand why, because, you know, that's not who you are today, but Evil Dead, yes, and on, but before Evil Dead, he doesn't like seeing people see what, you know.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah. And it gives, I mean, his stuff is still a lot better than a lot of other people's, you know, films. Sure. Or whatever. So he ends up, so they end up going on in Michigan and working on that. And while Bruce Campbell and Josh Becker are in the back of a truck one day on their way to the cabin, they start talking about Thou Shalt Not Kill Except, which was originally called Stryker's War. You know, he had changed the name from, he ended up changing the name from Bloodbath. Maybe it was called Bloodbath. Later it became Stryker's War.
Sure
it
wasn't Blood Wrath.
No, it did look like Wrath, not, but it was the Bloodbath is coming. And so they ended up talking about certain things. And I remember hearing that, like, he changed the story so much, or changed the script so much from the Bloodbath, that Sheldon got mad at him, you know, for it, because, like, you just destroyed what we worked on.
So,
you know.
But was that where it changed from being super serious to being a lot more Stooges influenced
and more
physical comedy?
18, more silly.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Okay.
It became, Bruce Campbell knows how to bring that stuff out. And then with him, he ended up writing with Scott Spiegel. And as you know, Scott Spiegel has a lot of one-liners and different things and jokes. And I guarantee you, the scene when they're at that bar and the guy said the joke about the guy or whatever at the bar, and, you know, and everything, that seems like something Scott Spiegel would have wrote. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that he would have thrown in. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Josh Becker wrote it. I'm just saying, like, a lot of, like, the silly comedy sometimes.
Seems like
I think
it was an influence more on his side.
What?
Just having going from the more serious side to the,
I think both of them
side
together, because Josh Becker does like the Stooges stuff too. Mm-hmm. He likes that kind of stuff.
Well, the Stooges they were on the TV on that one scene.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
they love
Hold the hands, you love birds.
Yep. So So they went and got together and worked on it. And he gave him, like, yeah. So Bruce Campbell basically gave him some fun ideas to make it more silly, but, you know, and not take itself so seriously.
Which works, because if you had done this as a serious movie, it just wouldn't have worked.
However,
the wrong tone.
They didn't just go right into getting the stuff for this. Scott Spiegel and Bruce Campbell both worked on a feature script for a Raiders of the Lost Ark parody that they were going to do called Cleveland Smith Bounty Hunter. We saw the short film version of that, and it was, you know,
it was fun.
It was goofy, and it was their proof of concept, and they spent 2 years trying to raise money for that film to no avail.
That's just shame.
You know, and so that was from 1982 to 1984. And then 84, at the end of 84, the fall of 84, they started working on the proof of concept for Jack, you know, for Stryker's War, and then I think by the end of that they started shooting the movie. So because it came out in 85, so I'm guessing it, there had to have been like a little bit of time that maybe they started shooting. So in fall of 84 they shot the short film version, and then that was what they were originally going to call it, was Stryker's War, because, you know, it took like that. So they made the feature film, and Scott helped raise the funds, and kept raising the funds for like for throughout the whole production. So even while they were shooting, mm-hmm. he was out there raising the funds when he wasn't on set, you know, or whatever. Let's see. Then when they were going to cast the movie, Josh had Bruce Campbell in mind, you know, because he kept writing for it to play the lead character, but he had joined SAG at that point, so he could not do it. And however, they did. You do see his legs somewhere, so I'm guessing that scene where you're like, "Yo, is that his legs?" I think that was his legs. So, let's see. When it was time for the release of the film, the guy who represented Evil Dead, uh-huh. you know, and who actually gave the Evil Dead title, you know, Irving Shapiro had sold and tested the name Stryker's War, and nobody liked it.
Sounds more serious.
Well, you know what they said?
But I will say this, though, and I don't know if there's any truth to this or not, but when I kept hearing the name Stryker, I'm always thinking Airplane. I'm like, Stryker, well, Ted Stryker.
There were other movies like Heart's War, and there were a few other movies that were already called somebody else's War.
So I don't know, that maybe that was just an homage to calling the guy Stryker or whatever, but or maybe there's nothing there, but Stryker's War sounds...
Stryker's Revenge might have been better.
So Irving Shapiro actually said that the reason that it did not test well is because people thought it was about a bunch of people on strike during a war.
Shit.
You know, and that's so weird. That was what, you know, it sounds like people on strike going to war or whatever.
Oh, God. So that's like, what was the movie with, Sally Field?
Oh, Norma Rae?
Yeah, Norma Rae.
Yeah.
Did Norma Rae come out around that time?
That was early 80s.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So, anyway, maybe. So maybe they did have a lot of people on strike or something. So anyway, he said, well, what did test well? And they go, well, the title of your film is going to be Thou Shall Not Kill Except. And he goes, that's not a title. That's a tagline. Mm-hmm. And he said, do you want me to represent your film? He goes, of course. And he was like, then the title is Thou Shall Not Kill Except. And Josh goes, okay.
I'm trying to think. It's like Thou Shalt Not Kill. It's like I'm trying to think if that's something military, just the I don't
religious
I don't
know. Aspects of like
the commandment type of stuff.
Commandment,
but then the accept puts a tongue in cheek element to it.
Yeah, except when you're drunk with your army buddies on the weekend and have nothing else better to do than to kill a bunch of evil hippies.
Who steal wallets?
Steal wallets.
And skin
and
dogs.
Yeah, skin them. We'll get to that later, but it's
That's one of those lines.
That's the horror part.
Yeah, so.
Thou Shalt Not Kill Except was given a limited release, theatrical release in 1985. Sam Raimi was voted worst director to ever act in someone else's film, so that was a fun award.
Maybe that's why you don't talk about it.
I did not see it in the theater, unfortunately. I remember when it came out, but I didn't get around to seeing it.
You remember when this came out in the theater?
Oh, yeah.
Because, see, to be honest, I had not heard of this.
I didn't get to see it. What I did see, though, was it was on VHS not that long
ago. I don't remember this ever being at, like, Blockbuster or anything like that back in the day either. So it must have just passed me.
Yeah.
You had to go to one of the Ma and Pa places that had a bunch of stuff, especially in the, you know, the kind that always had, like, the porn section in the back. They usually had a lot more variety of
the unrated,
horror
movies. The video updates. Is this even rated? Is it even rated R?
I think it's R.
Obviously, it'd be R if it was rated.
Yeah,
it'd
be an R.
It might not even be rated, but...
it might not be rated.
Well, there you go. That's why Blockbuster wouldn't even carry it.
Not rated, you're right.
Yeah.
Because they did have that 17-plus stuff, but for the most part, it had to be rated.
And it was just like
stuff.
A little flash of nudity, but it was mainly because of the violence, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, the little flash.
That was the it was that scene where the girl was getting it on in the car or whatever.
With like 25 people stuffed in the back of there and nobody could sell anything. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that
5 seconds.
The film was released on VHS by Star Maker Video in the late 80s. Hmm. It was later released on DVD in 2002 by Anchor Bay.
There you go. Anchor Bay always.
Mark of quality, baby.
Here's the thing. Anchor Bay actually, I believe, owned Star Maker or ended up buying out Star Maker's stuff.
Not familiar with Star Maker.
Yeah.
Anchor Bay, Mill Creek, you know. Same
Synapse
thing.
Released a Blu-ray with a ton of extras, and we talked about that. And so, now, okay, so this is your first time watching it. I do got to get your opinion. What did you think of it? Did you like it? Did you enjoy it?
There's a lot in there that I thought was kind of enjoyable. There's some parts of it it was just that I sort of just shook my head at. But I mean, some of the shot selections and stuff, some of it was a little not the best. But then there was some stuff I really enjoyed. So I mean, overall, it was my first take is like, hey, it's not bad.
Could be worse.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Most definitely could be worse. But, I mean, there's some things that I wish they would have done differently. I mean, there was one shot in it that really, I think, I've never seen it really done that way before. And it's usually when somebody goes into a house running and they're looking for stuff inside of a house, they run around inside the house with a camera and, like, really quick. But in this one, they sort of spun around the outside of the house a couple times to get to that one full time to get to the front door, and I thought that was kind of cool.
It was neat. It was different.
Yeah, it was different. And when you're looking at movies like this or any movie for that matter, you're looking for something that's going to have itself stand out.
Yeah.
And that stood out in itself. But the different people, some of the stuff was a little cringy. I mean, I called a couple lines.
There were a couple lines.
It was like we knew it was coming. But at the same time, there's some comforting aspects to that too when you know something's going to happen because it's deserved.
Here's the thing: when you make your first feature film, it is very okay for it to be formulaic because it's your first feature film, so it's your learning experience. And when you do a formula and do something that nobody has, that everybody has done before, it's safe, or whatever. Because sometimes Tarantino, people could have looked at him and did like Reservoir Dogs and could have been like, dude, this is too weird. I don't like this, And then it could have just fell completely, People like Paul would have been like, I love this. Other people would be like, this is too different for me.
Well, it's interesting because I do remember the very first time I rented this, I didn't like it. Because I just thought it was very cheap and very shoddy and very half-assed and very,
Well, that's what you were in your Hollywood days, right?
Well, no, it was more along the lines that I didn't know the background.
You actually liked Hollywood back then.
I know, right? That's what I was leading to. I was like, you were actually okay with Hollywood, so something like this.
Well, back then, Hollywood was still putting out
decent
movies.
That's what we're saying. Yeah, exactly. Because we actually know that back in those days, you were actually okay with what Hollywood was doing.
And this wasn't Hollywood.
But I still love the indie area. But the thing was, with this one, I didn't know the backstory enough about it. I didn't really know who was involved. I didn't know this was a first-time movie.
You didn't even know it was Sam Raimi.
No, and I didn't know a lot of that stuff. And so upon later seeing it again a couple of times, I came to appreciate it more and I came to understand
But you still more. Didn't know that,
but
that
I still
was,
didn't know that was Sam
Raimi.
Raimi.
Yeah.
No.
So that's funny.
Yeah.
I've always thought Sam Raimi, he seems, I mean, I know.
I knew he was involved, but I didn't know that was him.
He seems shorter in that he's not like, I mean, he's always wearing the suit. So this one, he's like really thin. I mean, he's wearing short, small clothes, so it's like it just didn't.
He's actually tall.
Yeah,
to be honest.
If I didn't know that was him going into it, I wouldn't have known.
Right.
And he was definitely towering over me, and I was like, wow. Yeah, because I always thought he was shorter.
He's got the wig, and he's got the black stuff in his teeth, and he's got the stuff in his face, and the clothes are kind of oversized.
In this one, the way they shot him, too, they could make him look... I mean, you can always make somebody look bigger by the way you shoot him and stuff like that.
Now that I've seen it, it's like, oh, God, how could you not tell it's Sam Raimi? Yeah. But, at the time, this was 20-some years ago.
No internet.
I didn't really pick it up.
Like, really?
I figured his involvement would have been behind the scenes, production stuff, maybe assistant directing, producing, something like that. Maybe writing. I didn't really know. But, again, Lunatics, the Love Story, which I also saw back in the day, that kind of clued me in. I was like, oh, I know that this guy's involved in this, so I'm going to go check it out.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, like I said, I did know Tim Quill.
Well, because, okay, so in 1985, when this first came out, Evil Dead was about the only thing that, I mean, there was another movie that Sam Raimi had done for Hollywood called Crime Wave that not a lot of people have seen.
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, we're going to do that at some point. It's really bonkers.
Great. And,
but the problem is it's also Hollywood fucked with and stuff, which is why Sam Raimi and them don't talk about it much.
But it's funny. It's the same thing that happened with Evil Dead. The original Evil Dead I thought was decent. I thought it was cool. I thought it had some really sort of groundbreaking camera work.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say that I loved it as a movie. But when they redid it, basically, as Evil Dead, man.
Evil Dead 2, you mean?
Yeah, Evil Dead 2 blew the doors off of everything. Everybody loved that movie. And it was a huge, huge success. And the same kind of thing happened. It seems like the first time they did it, it was very serious. And then the second time, they brought more comedic elements in it. And that just, that opened up so many different doors and made it so much more successful. And it was just amazing. A huge, then, huge difference.
And then it went really comedic with Army of Darkness. But,
you know. Oh, yeah. So, maybe a little too much in that one.
Yeah.
It was fun, but a little much.
So it was directed by Josh Becker, who worked on the original Evil Dead. He directed Lunatics of Love Stories, you said.
Do you know what he did on the original Evil Dead?
He was just crew work. I think he did...
The Detroit Mafia.
He did, like, other... And we'll get into that a little bit, I think. But he does, like, he did a little odd jobs. He was a production assistant, but he did more than that,
gotcha.
I think.
Gotcha.
Like, he did whatever they could. He has a whole... So I have one of his books called Rushes, which is a bunch of his... diaries, you know, entries and stuff about the making of, like, Thou Shalt Not Kill Except, Lunatics, and Evil Dead.
Nice.
And he actually talks about how, you know, how tough it was. It was not an easy shoot.
Sure.
And stuff. And they went through a lot of stuff.
This one or Evil Dead?
Yeah.
Any of them. Low-budget movie making is not easy.
If I'm correct, and I might be wrong, so don't necessarily quote me on this, but I do believe that Josh Becker got fired from Evil Dead because he was kind of arguing about certain things and stuff kind of causing too much, you know, kind of putting his own director things, you know, in there. And that kind of pissed off everybody in the crew at that point, even though they're all friends and he still loved them because they all worked with him some more. But I think they just got sort of, you know, when you're making a movie, tensions get high and people start throwing out their own ideas. And if you're not...
Yeah, it has to have a time and a place, chain of command.
Yeah.
Right place, right time, wrong place, wrong time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway, he also worked on a movie called Running Time, which we're eventually going to do here as well. If I Had a Hammer, which was... I had it on VHS because that was the only way you could get it through Josh. And it was cute. I had my parents watch it with me because, you know, because it's a folk music movie.
It legitimately was. The cute work sometimes means it's cute, like, oh, it was pretty good. But cute, like, if you're showing your parents, that's like, it means it's...
Shirley
okay.
Temple cute.
Yeah, it's just, it's like,
it's not R-rated cute. It's like PG cute.
Yeah, it's PG, PG-13. It was a nice little movie. I mean, you know, he's made a couple of those. Then he also did Alien Apocalypse. He's got a newer movie called Morning, Noon, and Night. And a Western, he did a Western called Warpath. That starred Tom Matthews from Jason.
Yeah, Jason 6.
And a ton of Xena and Hercules episodes. Yeah. And he also, because that
that's
was
right,
all
your heart, huh?
Sam Raimi.
The Xena stuff. Yeah.
And he did, what is that show that that they, not Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., but what was that other
one? Oh, the pirate one?
Yeah, I think that was the pirate one or something.
I forget the name of it.
But Bruce Campbell was the star of it or whatever. He also directed an episode of that. I forgot to write it down. So Scott Spiegel, who also wrote it, he co-wrote Evil Dead 2. He also directed a movie called Intruder that Sam Raimi's in and Ted Raimi's in. Co-directed The Nut House with, like, Adam Rifkin and all of them, and I really, really want that badly. It looks balls to the walls, bonkers and stuff. And kind of fits that. And then directed From Dusk Till Dawn 2, Texas Blood Money, and Hostel 3. He directed
Hostel 3?
Yeah, so he was part of Raw Nerve, which was the company that Eli Roth, Scott Spiegel, and Boaz Yakin? Yakin, whatever his name is. sorry, Boaz. I don't know your...
We're yanking your chain there, buddy.
Yeah. They worked on a movie, and forgot who... Somebody had actually pitched... Oh, I found this out. So we have a movie that eventually we're going to do called Gimme Skelter. And Scott Phillips, who did the movie we watched with John Ward in Las Vegas, the really weird Stink of Flesh movie.
Yeah, Stink of Flesh.
Scott Phillips had directed, his next movie was that he directed was Gimme Skelter, and he actually pitched that to Raw Nerve. And unfortunately, Raw Nerve was sort of having problems with the 2001 Maniacs at the time, so they were focused on that and never ended up making it. So he was like, well, I got this idea. Let me go make it myself. And, you know, that's how a lot of movies get made. You know, just why not? Let's see. The story was by Sheldon Lettich, or Josh Becker, Sheldon Lettich, who's director of Lionheart, Only the Strong, Double Impact. He also was the second unit director on this, it says. I don't know how. Like, I don't know if he came out to Michigan from Los Angeles to do that, but I saw it on IMDb, so it could be right, could be wrong.
Maybe he procured the stock footage.
Maybe.
Yeah, the stock footage was 1969 when they showed the... Yeah. I was like, yeah, there's no way they got that town set up to look like that. I was like, they in the coloring, obviously, that was it was a little bit grainier.
And the haystack made village. It was cute.
So Bruce Campbell also did the story, and he was the actor most commonly known for the Evil Dead movies, Burn Notice, but he's Congo. He's been in a lot of movies. You know, usually he's a small role, and he's kind of made a joke where... the smaller the role, the bigger the movie for him. You know, if it's a bigger the movie,
I can understand smaller that, yeah.
Role, yeah, kind of thing. He tends to do that. Now, he's got a bigger name because he did Burn Notice, which, like, my parents know that show. They like
Bubba Hotep.
I was thinking Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep was a big cult movie, but it's the same thing as Evil Dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that, like, mainstream audiences will know. You go on a man on the street in Fort Monroe and say, hey, have you ever heard of Bubba Hotep? 9 out of 10%, they're going to say no. There's going to be that one person that's probably heard of it.
Stupid general public.
I know. All right, so let's get into the actors real quick. Oh, actually, let's go into the story before we get into the actors. So, Joe, tell us, what can you tell us about the story?
So, it starts out, there's like with the four guys are out in Vietnam, and they basically have their missions. They show in the bunker, they're having an argument and stuff like that. It's just trying to show like the hierarchy between the two characters. But then it goes into the war, and where they almost, a couple of them almost die. And then it fast forwards up to where more of a, I don't say present day, U.S., I guess present day being 1969 for this.
But just get the part where they charge the make-believe village with guy riding piggyback on top of wannabe... God, what was his name?
Mr. T.
Well,
yeah, because the one guy, yeah, which we'll get into all the actors and all that at some point. But yeah, it was the talk of the it just some of the military aspects of this seemed a little
silly.
I guess it's probably maybe they wanted it to be that way. I think, but they tried to play it serious to a degree. Once the missions, a lot of smaller movies wouldn't have even done that if they were just trying to focus more on the second part of the story. So I think that was kind of cool that they actually did show that, not just that they came back from war with all these problems. They actually built that up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they get back to 1969 in the one guy, Stryker, he goes to get his dog, I guess, who's been being
6 years in a kennel.
Being taken care of by a buddy or whoever.
Well, okay, that was the weirdest kennel.
It was somebody's house.
Yeah, like, that's what I was going to say.
Is it like Happy Valley Kennels or something?
Yeah. I know. Like, they made a sign. House,
they made a sign, they stuck it, and that was the kennel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah, because the guy comes in and sits down, and I'm like, this does not look like the kennel I've ever seen.
The only reason you even would think it is because, I don't know if you noticed, when he sat down, they had a big bag of dried dog food next to the chair. That's it. Otherwise, it's just a house in Michigan in the 80s.
Yeah. And even then, there might be a bag of dried dog food in someone's house, you know?
Yeah. So he picks up his dog, and he's starting to head home. The town father, grandfather, whoever it was.
Otis
to him, but then seemed like a stepdad to him, a grandfather to the girl, and anyways,
Otis gets around.
Yeah, he was sort of the old wise man of the town, basically.
Yeah, he didn't talk about the father; he just talked about the mother. Yeah. You know, your mother would have been so upset at you.
Feeling he knows everybody's mother.
Yeah. I know, right? So, in the process of him going home, the dog Whiskey finds. A hand or something in the woods.
A corpse.
Trying
to eat it.
Did they ever show where that corpse came from or anything?
It was one of the people that they had murdered earlier or whatever. Because you missed that part. Is like that there is a Manson family basically that's going around killing. Because one of the funniest scenes is the guy looks out the peephole and sees Sam Raimi's face, you know, teeth and everything. Like,
anybody know a filthy hippie?
A filthy hippie with really bad teeth.
Yeah, and, not mentioning that part, now go back to it. There's a lot going on here in this story, which is, I think, is kind of cool. I mean, that they would. A smaller independent film usually it's very small and focused. But this actually had some grander elements to it.
Right. I mean, it wasn't a movie that took place in like one location.
Exactly.
And that was it.
Exactly.
You know.
So they dealt with a cult. The cult starts to establish there. The military guys they're split up, and the three other ones are sort of wanting to find their buddy. At first, I thought it was a seek revenge on him. I thought they were upset at him or something.
And I presume they're still in the military, and that's why they're still in uniform?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, did they just get out or something? Because they're all, like, still in uniform.
I shouldn't think so, because if they were out, they're not going to be wearing those uniforms.
And why are they going to be driving around like that?
He just happens to live right here.
Well, no, because at one point, they get out of, like, they go to the... the base, the army, the military base, right? Because they're at one of the places, and then they're like, oh, you know what? We're right by where Stryker lives. Let's go see him.
And the other thing, it's like, I don't know how it works for most people, but I don't know. Most enlisted men are not buddy buddies with the CEOs. It just doesn't really work like that.
I mean, but I think what they're trying to say is because.
I know he felt bad about
it. I know. He felt bad, and, like, he was, like, the leader, you know, guy or whatever, and he was just, like, trying to... And you said that was Tim Quill, right, you think? Yeah. So he was just trying to, like, you know, talk, you know what I mean? Like, he was trying to be there.
I know. They're trying to figure out a reason for him to be there.
Yeah.
It's a little flimsy, but it's all right. It doesn't matter, ultimately.
Yeah. So the three guys are working their way to meet the fourth guy, Stryker. And they go to a bar, and they get into it with the biker gang, and Grant Otis is there along with the girl that Stryker. They start to build a story with them.
Sally.
Oh, yeah, Sally.
The one they're building a relationship. And they had a flashback earlier of them in high school, too. So there's a lot of stuff going on with a lot of different characters.
She was a petulant little shit, frankly.
Yeah.
Well, you were just mad because she didn't want, she said this stuff about prom.
Aren't you going to go to prom with me? I never want to see you again!
Well, you know, that's how it was in 1969, I'm sure.
But I like the little biker gang fight thing. I mean, I know that it was kind of a little cheesy violence.
A little cheesy.
The one guy, what was it you said? The one guy, he made a motion up and he keeled over basically from that versus being hit or anything.
Too huge.
So they deal with the fight. And ultimately, the guys all get together, and they go looking for Whiskey, which has gone. The dog's gone missing in the woods.
The dog's like screeching in pain, and the guy's like, "Oh, Whiskey. Oh well, I guess he ran off."
I swear to God, if my dog was screeching in pain like that, I would be looking everywhere for the dog.
I guess he ran off. I guess he got put in the blender.
Jesus Christ.
So the next morning they all go out in the woods, and then they run into the cult, and then there's the battle between the cult and the four military guys, basically. Little things happen before that where Sally gets kidnapped and Otis gets spoiled killed. then it's basically the battle between the cult and the four military guys.
And that's the gist
of the story.
We'll get into more like specific scenes in a second, but I just wanted, the overall story of the film.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into the cast, and we can talk some fun stuff about that. So Brian Schultz played Jack Stryker, which was S stand for? I don't know. S Sergeant Jack Stryker.
Staff Sergeant.
Oh, there you go.
Staff Sergeant.
It's a military ranking.
Staff Sergeant Stryker.
Pretty young to be a Staff Sergeant, frankly.
Yeah. Robert Rickman as Sergeant Walker J. Jackson.
Which one was that?
That was the Mr. T. Oh.
That was Mr. T?
That was Mr. T. And,
Pity the Fool.
Yeah, it was the only movie, but he was a Michigan Mr. T impersonator.
Oh, this is his only movie as well?
He was actually pretty good.
So it was Brian Schultz's only movie and Robert Rickman's only movie. John Manfredi as Second Lieutenant David Miller. He was the guy with the mustache. He was Love Machine. He acted in Game of Death in 2011. Not the original Game of Death, but Bruce Lee.
Not Bruce Lee's Game of
Please,
Death.
Please, any movie swap Bruce Lee with Bruce Campbell. That would be so much fun.
So, The Ides of March, Real Steel, and more. He's been in a lot of stuff. He later got back into it.
Yeah, that's more like recent stuff. I know. Real Steel and Ides of March, that's like in the last 15 years or so.
So, those are like, that. He got into it, got back into it later. I think he was probably missing it after this movie, and stuff.
Love Machine still. That's
Timothy Patrick Quill as Lieutenant Corporal...
Tim Tyler.
Yeah, we just called him that.
Lieutenant Dan.
Lieutenant Dan.
I mean, I didn't even think of his given name in the film. It just was Lieutenant Dan to me.
Yeah,
I think
we just kept calling him Lieutenant Dan.
Because
he's the one that got carried off when he got
Your
shot.
Legs working yet?
And it wasn't. Yeah, and it was the other guy that got carried off. It wasn't even him. Yeah. He didn't get his legs shot off.
Yeah, but there was a lot of Forrest Gump references, which is fun.
This was made before Forrest Gump, so yeah.
So maybe Robert Zemeckis is a fan.
There you go.
He acted in The Quick and the Dead. He was in an episode of Oz, a TV show. And you said you actually knew him.
Well, we went to the same school. I knew his brother. I was in the same class as his brother, Tim, or as his Jim. And there was a Jim Quill. There was a Leonard Quill. There was a Tim Quill.
There was a Jim and a Tim.
There was a bunch of them. Yeah,
they're the Quills.
Yeah, and he was a couple years older than me. So
where was this?
This was in Wilmington, Delaware. This was St. Mark's High School, baby.
How? So did he move to Michigan?
Well, he moved. I think he went to L.A. But maybe he stopped there along the way. I'm not really sure. I knew of him. He wasn't a friend of mine. None of the Quills, frankly, were. But
he might have met either Sam Raimi.
Makes sound like a cult.
They kind of were.
like a little clique or something.
They kind of were. Yeah.
So he might have met. So that's interesting.
But we all knew that the brother went off to Hollywood to become an actor. That was
okay. So he met either Sam or Josh, because Josh had moved to. L.A. before Sam, interestingly enough. So while they were all making their little shorts and other things and stuff, Josh, at the age of like 17 or 18, he just went off to L.A. He moved to L.A. I think he was 18, must have, whatever. So he, instead of going to college or whatever, he just went to, maybe he did, I don't know, but he went to L.A. and lived there, and he made a whole book called Going Hollywood, which was just him going off to Hollywood, realizing it wasn't for him at that time because things were changing, as you know. Like, the Hollywood became a different thing, and the movies that he wanted to make, they weren't making. You know, so he had to make them independently.
Well,
so
the straight to video stuff eventually. And
yeah,
smaller.
That was the big thing back then. Yeah.
And so he would. So he went off to Alaska. Then he went to Michigan, I believe. So
interesting.
Yeah.
I guess a job called or something. Yeah.
No. He just felt like walking to Alaska or something. It was weird.
Walking. That sounds like Kane or something like that. He walked the earth.
It was.
Gonna walk the earth. You mean you're gonna be a bum?
Yeah.
I mean,
so
I want to visit back to Alaska.
That's a great Pulp Fiction reference.
It is.
I'd like to visit Alaska again. I mean, that's where I was born, but it's like, I mean, I don't know.
Really?
I was born in Alaska.
That. I didn't know what part?
Anchorage.
You and Riker.
That's the only place I know of in Alaska. I feel like it's like the only city.
Helmendorf Air Force Base. Yeah, it was really weird. I've never been back, first year of my life. Although I did in high school here in the Hampton area, one of the kids that rode the same bus as me was born in the same hospital, like a few days away from me. So, and we halfway around the world, all these years later, we ran into each other. So, but Alaska. So, I walked from California to Alaska. I guess, hey, whatever rocks your boat, I guess.
Interesting. There is the Pacific Trail, which I believe goes from Baja California all the way up. But you know, that's a hell of a hike. You know, it's like the Appalachian Trail, only longer.
They did that when Forrest went cross country in Forrest Gump. There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Another
run, Forrest, run!
Yeah, interesting. So,
and there were filthy hippies in that.
Yep.
All right. Then he sadly passed away.
Who did?
Timothy Patrick Quill.
Yeah.
You know that. Heard about
it. He was the the one who vomited.
On himself. Yeah, he's Lieutenant Dan. He passed away in 2021 at the age of 83. So that's it. Cheryl Guttridge as Sally. She was also Sally in the Cleveland Smith.
83.
As well as a fake ship in The Evil Dead. She hasn't acted in anything that wasn't Sam Raimi attached.
Must have been 63 because.
Yeah. You would have known him.
Speaking of Sam Raimi attached, Sam Raimi as a cult leader. And you will know him as the director of the Evil Dead trilogy, the first Spider-Man trilogy, has acted in Spies Like Us, which we just reviewed for Hollywood Boulevard podcast. I think Hudsucker Proxy, he's done a lot of stuff with the Coen brothers because they were all friends.
Darkman.
Darkman. I mean, just tons of great stuff.
Oh, the one with the Drag Me to Hell.
No, or the gift know. Where
the gift.
Where they gave he gave us the gift of Katie Holmes's titties, you know.
That was actually a really good movie.
And I know you guys probably don't agree with this one, but I really like For Love of the Game. So
I do, too. Baseball. I'm a big
baseball romance movie.
I don't like watching baseball like Paul does. Paul loves watching his baseball. I'm not a big fan of watching it, but I'll watch the movies based on it.
That's still one that I can't believe Sam Raimi did, and that just shows his diversity.
He also did A Simple Plan, which was a thriller, kind of thing. So
thrillers,
he's done
romantic
Oz
dramas,
the Great and Powerful. Yeah. Like, he's done different stuff.
Yeah, which
like,
is,
he's
which is
not.
Cool. It's really good.
Yeah. He's a director that when you call him in, you know he's going to direct.
Billy Bob Thornton movie.
The Simple Plan, right?
Yeah. But as an actor, though?
Yeah, as an actor, though, he's not really, you know. And he usually just plays cameos. This is his, like, biggest role I've ever seen him in and stuff.
He does have like sort of an evil eye type of weird presence.
And a sort of manic energy to him.
Yeah.
The music was done by Joe LaGuca, who did The Evil Dead, Intruder, Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Nice.
Interestingly enough.
Love
Legend of the Seeker. He did the music for the Chucky series. You know, TV series, as well as the new Chucky movies.
Yes, he's currently active.
Is that the one with Meg Tilly?
Jennifer Tilly.
Sorry, Jennifer Tilly.
Yeah.
Get the two confused sometimes.
Are they related?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know they were sisters. Yeah. I did not know that. I know they have the same last name, but sometimes people have the same last name and there's no relation. And
they have a look in their eye area.
Although I always said my crush was always on Meg and not on the other one.
Psycho 2.
I love Jennifer Tilly. I'm sorry. I have a huge crush on her.
You can have her. I'll take Meg.
Okay.
The Meg.
I'm sorry, Joe. You're already married. Sorry. So.
Yeah, that's
yeah, you're
right.
married, so you're fine.
And Meg and Jennifer probably, if they heard this, they'd probably be like, yeah, right. No, but yeah.
But it's funny because like whenever I think of
fighting
Jennifer
over
Tilly,
some dorky losers,
everybody thinks of her from Chucky, but I always think of her from Liar Liar.
Well, I was thinking Liar Liar.
Like, yeah, Chucky, with yeah. me and Jackie, always love that movie.
Yeah, well, Meg though from Psycho too is.
So special makeup effects were done by Gary Jones, by the way.
Hmm.
So all the makeup effects, like the I guess the squibs and other the crazy
good.
Stuff. Yeah. He was the director of Jolly Roger, Massacre at Cutter's Cove, which we've done.
And you know, it's all practical stuff. It all looked pretty darn good.
He did Axe Giant, Mosquito, and more. Like he's done a lot of special effects for stuff. I think he did a lot of Evil Dead stuff too.
So he did like the shears to the eyes and stuff
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that would be him.
Yeah, there was some good stuff, effective usage of stuff in this.
So this is actually going to be a longer video because we're already at the 50 mark.
Wow.
Yeah, I a lot of my backstory took a lot longer. It's just there's a lot to this movie.
Yeah, you Bogart and the microphone over there.
Not meaning to. It's just there's so much.
Well,
here.
Continuity Monkey left the room during it because he did have a few.
Yeah, we had a few.
Bring up the continuity stuff.
Yeah, probably the biggest one is the red bloody hands on the boobs. You know, when the cult leader is for whatever reason decides to stick his hands in a bucket of blood and then. Grab Sally's boobs, and then we see her later, and she's in that nice white top,
and
the hands
clean.
Are gone.
It felt like they might have shot that before the scene, and then they didn't know that they were going to
I like to think that as soon as Sally escaped, she found herself a puddle, got herself a toothbrush and some bleach, and just cleaned her top then put it back on.
Well, but it took some time anyway, you know.
Well, it's just like the military. Well, she seemed awfully disheveled still.
Or maybe all the tears from losing whiskey.
Yeah.
Well, she didn't know about whiskey.
She didn't really know whiskey too much. But the the drill sergeant guy or the leader of the his shirt got cleaned up from his vomit too. So
yep.
Well, no, but he was told to go clean up his vomit because there's that one part where he goes, "You stink. You need to be cleaned up, sir."
And he's like, "But you don't have electricity or a washing machine or a dryer, so how am I going to get cleaned up?"
He didn't say that.
No, that's what I'm saying. When he's in a shack, he's in a wooden shack. How's
he
going to clean up?
He didn't have another shirt either.
No, he didn't.
Yeah. As far as I know, because otherwise, why would he be wearing his his uniform the whole time? Like,
and then the big twist, which I don't know if we mentioned it or not, is the fact that after they picked up those girls, they were in the hippie cult because they stole Lieutenant Dan's wallet, and he finds it in the shack later on.
Yeah, I was like, "Give me my wallet back, bitch!"
And then guess what he says?
Bitch.
And what's even funnier is if you remember in the car where she's like squeezing his thigh, and then they said he's going to make his move, and she's like, "Not here." And I'm like, "Yeah, you're stuck with Pat Benatar wannabe because
she
of her
was trying
hair."
She was trying to lure him into the cult.
Could be
their web.
But it turns out when he shoots her in the shack, the wig comes. It was a wig the whole time. Although you could tell she's got like
she screamed when her wig came off. She was like,
she's got a bald head smash.
She never wanted anybody to find out she was really bald.
It was just it was just like an extra bit of weirdness that they threw in there because you didn't need to do that. But
it was Sinead O'Hara.
Yeah, Sinead O'Hara.
poor chick. I don't know.
There was something at the beginning too, in the war sequence. I know they were trying to do what they could to make that war, the Vietnam stuff look good. But I think you might have mentioned something about it, Paul, when we were watching it. It's just that they seemed awfully clean.
Oh yeah,
and awfully well. Hair was pretty cut, lined pretty well. Beards, no dirt. Their clothes look kind of clean. It's like they probably could have dirtied them up a little bit better.
I mean, think about first thing that happens in Full Metal Jacket is they cut pretty much all your hair off. If you're a Marine and you're in field, you're not going to be rocking beards and mustaches and full hair.
And full hair, yeah.
The one guy actually, I can't remember his name, basically the one, Mr. T, his beard, he kind of had a look that looked a little bit more, he was a little bit scruffy.
A little bit more
like
he was in country.
So, yeah, exactly. So it's like the other ones, though, it seemed like their haircuts were perfectly aligned. The mustache was in alignment. It was like, oh boy, for Love Machine.
So he was Sergeant Walker J. Jackson. And like, you never hear anybody's real name except for Stryker. You only hear Stryker's name said a bunch of times. Nobody goes, hey, Walker, you know, blah, 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 you know, right? Like, nobody does that. Everybody, nobody says anybody's name, really. And so when you're watching the movie, you're just, you know, it's just like you're, okay, you have to, like, label them. Like, that's the Mr. T guy, that's the Lieutenant Dan, that's Love Machine, because he actually does.
And it's
name.
Funny because, you know, since this is an action thing, the character has to be named Sam Stryker.
Jack Stryker.
He can't be like, you know, I don't know, Winky Poofy Pants. You can't have an action hero named Winky Poofy Pants.
But why not?
Because nobody will believe it, I guess.
But the thing was,
call me Winky.
Even though we didn't know the
that should be a title.
The bulk of their names, I mean, they did write them very specific enough to where they had their own identities.
Right.
That was cool. That was well done. So, and they didn't have too many people, because it's like, that's what happens in some movies now. It's like, you have too many people. It's like cult member number 14 or something like that. And
there's continuity too. I mean, the fact that they start off as a bunch of 18-year-old drunks, you know, in Vietnam, and later on, they're just a bunch of, you know, brotard drunks after the army too. So,
but they're all the same. They look the same.
I mean, they're the same.
I mean,
it's like they went from one day shooting to the next day.
Pretty much
the same costume.
Just their hair a little shorter or something.
Well, but they did say stuff about how the one guy was suffering from PTSD and that he couldn't sleep. And I think that probably goes into, when you were saying the original draft of this was 180 pages, there's probably elements of that
because
seriousness that was probably
says
still there.
It, but it doesn't really.
Yeah,
it's not really reflective
so
in the
I'm
movie.
I'm pretty sure. Yes, I'm pretty sure they cut out a bunch of the more serious stuff, because I guarantee you, Sheldon Lettich wrote a lot of the serious stuff of what actually happens in Vietnam, and that's not what Josh wanted to tell, because, you know, because that's just kind of like
because
been
it,
done.
It has
you know?
The feeling like they would have been getting together for a different reason, like the lieutenant who's burdened by all of these PTSD and memories and all this, you know, goes off hinge, and he's the one who becomes the killer, and then his friends have to help him or something, or cover it up, or yeah, I can see how that story would have gone in a different way, you know what I mean? But they decided to go in a completely different way and make it a little bit more fun and a little bit lighter.
Yep.
And in the mid to late 80s, they started doing a lot, and now they're commonplace, where you have these military people going and facing, in this case, cult. I mean, I'm thinking of other stuff like, was it Predator and stuff like that, where they go and face monsters or whatever, military group of people and stuff like that. But this predates all that stuff for the most part. So
yeah, I mean, I don't think, I think that's the sort of like,
I guess not
where
aliens, but
maybe things were heading toward that, you know, where... you know, they have to, you know, because with Josh Becker, when he was coming up with the idea, as I said, he was thinking, well, he wanted, what was going on in 1969? Oh, the Manson family. Well, who's going to fight them? Oh, the Vietnam was just ending. So like, or whatever, like all the Vietnam people will come back. So let's have Vietnam people fighting the Manson family, because, you know, and then maybe John McTiernan and the people who made Predator were like, well, who? I think Shane Black, didn't he write that or something? Or he was in it.
And then, of course, Quentin Tarantino ripped off this movie by having his own
Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah, Manson family thing.
Oh, that was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, yeah.
Right.
But that was, I mean, honestly, that was a cool like little twist on everything. And you got to think, because Tarantino actually did know Scott Spiegel and Josh Becker. They did not have a... there's a funny story where... what's his name? Josh Becker used to write for Film Threat. And so he had to interview... I think it was Film Threat. But he had to interview Quentin Tarantino. So he did this, serious. You would have loved it and love him, because he, like, does not hold back on his thoughts and his stuff. And
good for him.
He kind of says that, like... You know, he mentions that, like, Tarantino is not, is ugly and, you know, his gangly teeth and stuff like that and all these things. And he, and later he asked for a job to Lawrence Bender, and Lawrence Bender, the producer, is like, You said I was a thief, and you called Tarantino ugly. I'm not. We're not working with you.
No.
You know, and he was like, "Oh well, you know, moving on." Yeah. You know, because like he doesn't. He's more honest and more, and that's a lot of what gets him in trouble in Hollywood. That's he will not work in Hollywood necessarily because
gotta kiss some butt.
Yeah, you gotta kiss ass. You gotta
he's
not.
He's that square peg, and it's.
He's
the Neil Breen in a Hitchcock society.
Right, but he's like he's honest and he's very serious about like, you know, wanting to make something good instead of just listening to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. He hates most of what Hollywood puts out, you know, and stuff, and just doesn't like what's going on right now. So he hasn't like he'll watch it and he'll just be like, yeah, I don't
sounds like some
it.
Other people we know.
Yeah.
I think you get along with him.
You can tell though that there are very conscious efforts to lean towards physical humor of like the Three Stooges type in a lot of the scenes, especially a lot of the fight scenes, you know, like when the sword gets stuck in the tree and, you know, some of the other physical things that occur. Because had they wanted to go in a very dark direction, either with the Manson type killings or, you know, they could have done the village in the first part, like a more like a My Lai Massacre kind of thing. I mean, those things are not funny. You can't make those things funny, but they chose to sort of gloss around that and to go with the mashup fight of the one side versus the other and to do all these fun little physical humor things and physical special effects things that they could do and show off and say, hey, let's do the shears in the eyes and let's do the, you know, the pin cushion thing. Let's do, you know, the car thing. That was fun where the guy gets crushed by the
That was that fake body that was there. I was like, ooh.
But it worked. You know, I mean,
it worked for me.
You could tell it was fake, but it didn't matter. It worked nicely enough. Well, so
and they made little comments through one of the comments that really caught me. It was really. Really quick, they were showing the dating of the time period they were in, but it also made a little comment from the writers and everything. And that was at the beginning when they said when they were in had the TV or the radio news playing, they said that Judy Garland had died, but they started it by saying a cult member has been killed or they killed all these different people or something like that. So they say that, then they say Judy Garland died and says, oh, this has been a rough year because so and so and so and so
Boris
died.
Karloff.
And that's the thing. The point was that Boris Karloff had died in. Of all that stuff that they mentioned in that news thing, the one guy references Boris Karloff.
I really like Karloff.
And
too.
I think that was a cool gesture in this because that was sort of a tip of the hat to Karloff.
I think it was also an
importance of the horror elements of the past.
Maybe, but I think also it was more along of a joke of like, you know, he was talking about the Manson family killing everybody or whatever. And then the guy says, you know, is talking about, oh, yeah, I miss Karloff.
Interesting. I was just watching The Black Cat the other night.
Nice.
Yeah, so I just like that because I like when filmmakers do a tip of the hat. Not so shoving it down your throat, but a sort of tip of the hat at who might have inspired them. Maybe.
Well, they definitely did that with the Stooges, because like you said, you've got the little Stooges thing where he's in there, and that was nice. Yeah. I always like to see that. They do that often, though. Sam Raimi does that,
too. Yeah, there'll be stuff in some of these movies where it's like they'll have a movie playing on the screen, and it'll be like an original version of somebody that's in the movie or made the movie. It was their version or something.
I have this vision where all the Detroit Mafia and all their buddies and friends and producers and crew as little kids all gathered together in one big giant group with cereal bowls sitting there on the Saturday afternoon watching the Three Stooges together and all laughing and having a lot of fun.
Go from there to the wrestling
giant
and stuff
bowls
like that.
Of cereal.
And then they make their own version.
And then they had the B-horror stuff that was on.
Because this definitely has, and this is, again, the biggest difference between the first time I saw it and then subsequent times that I saw it. I didn't pick up so much, or I didn't care so much for the backyard movie with your friends and family feel or spirit that this has. I didn't care for it initially because I was still stuck in more of a Hollywood frame of mind back then. Later, when I saw it again and I was a lot more indie, and I was like, oh, okay, this is a plus. This isn't a negative. This actually feels cool. I like this. And given the fact that this was a low budget movie, And they still managed to pull the stuff off, and it was fun, in spite of the fact that they don't have the kind of money that a Hollywood movie, you know, it became different. It was a different context.
It's almost 40 years old.
I know, that's crazy.
Like, that's nuts, because it was 85 that it came out, and this podcast will come out in 2024, so, like, one more year later, I should have saved it. I don't know. For its 40th anniversary, but
maybe there'll be a 40th anniversary Blue or 4K.
Maybe Synapse, you know, get on that, and then put us on the back covers.
I will say one of the things I did mention several times to you is how clear the movie looked.
Yeah,
very different than the couple of times that I'd seen it on VHS. Uh-huh. So I never saw it on DVD. Because it didn't come out until, 2003 or 2004, something like that. It came out much later.
Right.
And that it's been that long since I'd seen it. So
even the stock footage?
Even the stock footage looked better. Yeah, it all looked good. Let's put it that way.
Well, the Blu-ray, they definitely did clean it up. And I would love to see a 4K of this. I think
I can imagine seeing this on like a VHS or something.
I would love to see this in a theater. Like, I mean, I'm kind of... Did you say you saw it in the theater?
No, I didn't see it in the theater.
Oh, okay. Because you said earlier you remember when it came to theater, but would have been great. This would have just been fun. You would have hated it, though, because if you had the Hollywood frame of mind.
At that time, I was, I
would have been like, what the fuck is this? This is not Hollywood.
I had been seeing a lot of movies like that, and I just had a less of a taste for it. But again, the fact that people who were involved in this, is what also made it a lot more palatable for me.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of reminds me a little bit like Deadly Prey and all those backwoods movies that were action movies set with Vietnam, people or whatever, going around killing everybody. The 80s was sort of like, because the 60s had been enough time, it passed where they're like, okay, let's now we can bring back the 60s and talk about the 60s. And stuff. And that's kind of how we are now, is like we bring back like the early 2000s and 90s and everything.
Because even back then, I was digging the Troma movies. I was digging, Donald G. Jackson movies. Mm-hmm. Of course, I loved Ray Dennis Steckler and Ed Wood and all that. So I knew all that stuff. It's just, to me at the time, it just felt like this was a Troma wannabe.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's just...
It's better than Troma. Come on.
Well, yeah. And it's done in a more of an independent backyard cinema kind of feel.
I don't think Sam Raimi would want anything on, like, to say Troma on the things that he worked on.
Some of the earlier stuff is pretty good, though. I mean, it was, Toxic... First Toxic Avenger is a lot of fun.
What's that, Class of Nukem High? That kind of stuff was... goofy and silly, but they were fun. And so, but now...
Surf Nazis Must Die? Come on.
But some of the stuff like Actium Maximus? Come on now.
Well, no, yeah. But they didn't make that. I know. They just distributed that crap.
They chose to distribute.
Yeah, they chose. Somebody said, yes, let's put this movie out. I don't know why.
I guess money... Maybe they were going to make money from it, so they...
Because
people like Paul buy it.
Exactly. Now, whatever content it is, it's still content, and someone... will like it. There's no accounting for taste out there. You just got to have content. Someone will buy it.
Was there anything else we wanted to say? Is there anything that we left?
I wouldn't say. I liked the, like I said, there were little bits and pieces production-wise that reminded me of Evil Dead and some of the other Sam Raimi movies. So you could definitely tell it's of a similar type or a similar group of folks that were working together.
Mm-hmm.
Different people kind of came back and forth, and you could tell there was influence. So that was also really good, too. I enjoyed seeing some of that. Mm-hmm. But overall, it reminded me. It was a decent movie. I had to see it a couple of times to appreciate it. But
I think it's a movie that probably grows on you a little bit, maybe. Joe, did you really enjoy it? Like, was this something you'd ever watch again?
I'd probably watch it again. I mean, it's not something I'm going to, like, jump at to watch, like, tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it's not one that I'd be like, if somebody hadn't seen it before, or we were showing it to, like, a group of people, and be like, it wouldn't list, like, groans for me to say, oh, I got to put this on.
You wouldn't show it to your wife?
No.
But say...
No, this isn't her cup of tea.
Say so. Next year for the 40th, it comes out at the Narrow in Hampton. Kind of like some of the other movies that they did at the Narrow. Would you guys go and see it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely want to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
The opportunity to see anything that you even marginally like, on a chance to see it on a big screen, especially when it's 30, 40 years old.
Especially when it's cleaned up like this.
Yeah, definitely. We got to watch Clerks on the big screen, and that was just a cool, like, because I never got to see it in the theater. Mm-hmm. So when I see movies like that or Jaws or The Room, you know, I get to see it in the theater, you know? Like, it's a...
Tommy Wiseau's butt.
This one you got to see Love Machines.
There you go.
And this wouldn't be something like Riff Tracks would do because it's too unserious, or it's like, you know, it's too goofy at times.
I could see them doing it. I don't know that they. I don't think Misty would do it, but I could see Riff Tracks is a little bit wider in scope as far as some of the movies that they.
But I'm just like, I'm looking at this and I'm like, this is too silly. Like,
there's tonal shifts in this. Yeah, there's some very serious parts to it. And not serious. I don't know if this
actually, is a Riff Tracks thing. I mean, I could, especially when they had the rat scene, and they'd be like,
that
was funny.
They would poke fun at that.
That rat was bad.
The rubber rat, you see later.
At least they put some blood on it. But the live mouse that they had.
Yeah,
the live mouse that was probably someone's pet. It had some moments.
At least it wasn't a gerbil or a hamster.
Well, because they're like, and they were saying rat, and so it's funny because they had a rat as the rubber rat, but they had a mouse, you know. And he was like, I'm going to get this rat, you know.
That's one was extremely furry, the other was extremely plastic.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, so it was, it's something like, I could see it again in the future. I mean,
yeah. All right. Well, we are at that time, actually, interestingly enough. And we're going to be doing the stinkometer. I'm going to be telling you guys how the stinkometer works because I guess I'm going to be doing that from now on, Paul.
I don't know about from now on, but...
Well, for me. Yeah, for my episodes.
For your episodes.
For my episode. I'm not saying, you know, every time.
That works.
So basically for the people at home who are not familiar with the stinkometer, the stinkometer is a 1 to 10 scale, 1 being very, very good, 10 being very, very stinky and bad. Now, when it's bad, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a... you know, it usually means that it has a lot of problems. Like, we can't see anything, we can't hear anything. Things are just really just bad and just...
Because we still enjoy stinky movies. Yeah, that's the whole point we do this.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of stink, and stink is fine sometimes, you know. But, you know, especially in low budget, you're just going to have that. You know, but when it comes to, like, you know, stuff like Lunatic's A Love Story got a little bit lower on a scale. I think this might get a little bit of a higher scale than that. But this was his first film. You can do like 1 through 10, or you can do a 0.5 if you feel like you can't do, 6.5 or 7.5 if you can't do 6.
Can't pick between 6,
six
or
7. Or 7 or 8.
Go with 6.5.
I'm going quarters. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Do not do anything that goes too crazy.
No, we've had that.
John Johnson wanted us to give like a negative something. And I'm like,
.333.
Somebody else wanted to do something like that. We're like, no.
We
bent the system once for 10 plus, and that was for David the Rock Nelson. We will do things for David the Rock Nelson because he's awesome.
Or we did Shark Exorcism.
Yeah, well, since the precedent has been set.
Yeah, plus, so.
Wow, that means it was revoltingly bad in multiple
unprecedented levels. Unprecedented. Yeah. It was a new precedent.
It's so bad. It gets a 10 plus. But... I don't even know how that works if not everybody agrees on a 10+. Yeah. I guess it doesn't. I guess it has to calculate. It has to have at least 2 pluses.
Well, we're definitely.
I think we'd all have to say that's 10 beyond plus. 10.
Yeah.
It'd be that
Shark Exorcist is really bad.
Sort of the holy grail of of cinematic.
There are worse movies than that. Let me tell you.
Yeah, there are worse ones.
It's on those sketchy sites.
So, Joe, you're our guest. Would you like to go first?
Sure. Two things that I know in the past when I've said a few things that, like, if it hit a moral line and stuff like that. Two of them, they approach things, but it was like, one is I hate when they mess with dogs. But that dog, even if it was whiskey, it still looked like a pig or a deer skin or whatever.
Deer or something
like
that.
Which still, so it sort of played it off a little bit. And then the other thing, when Raimi closed in on that baby, it was just like, and then they cut away. They never addressed that. You could sort of imply what happened, but
They approached the line like with the dog, but they don't cross it. Like, I'm thinking, Wonton Town where the dog tries to commit suicide.
Yeah, that's a different story. Well, this one, though, I think they started to put one foot over because they actually showed a carcass, if you will. So, but I can dismiss that in this one because there's
or I'm thinking the janitor where things were pretty
when you're drinking something that's not liquid from it's coming from a body or whatever that's a little different story it's nothing there. Filmmaking aspects, a lot of good actually. There was a few things production wise that I think they could have done better, but new to the thing, so nothing bad there. Story, liked a lot of the stuff they did in the story. I'm going to cut right back down the middle. I'm just going to go five and a half. I definitely watchable again, to your point, especially if they put it on the big screen. I'd love to see that on the big screen just to see some of the it'd be one of those fun event type of things.
Yeah, I would love to see the mouse and be a big screen, the rat, and everything.
Five and a half. I don't have any big qualms.
Okay, what about you, Paul?
I'm probably going to go just a little half step more than you. Probably go with a 6. It definitely has some stinkier elements to it, but there's a lot of good stuff in there, too. And like I said, I've seen this a number of times and have come to appreciate it from when I first saw it and did not like it to, upon further review, I think the score gets a little bit lower and a little bit lower and a little bit lower. But there are some still stinky parts that are attached to it, and you're going to get that with a low-budget, make-it-in-the-backyard-with-your-friends-and-family kind of movie, because there's not much you can do. You can only do so much with a low budget. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that they went more towards the physical humor, and I'm glad that it fits in with that sort of Raimiverse of physical humor, comedy with Stooges background, Bruce Campbell stuff. It all. I wish Bruce Campbell. If Bruce Campbell had been in this would have knocked 2 more points right off of that.
More than just
because you're right. Yeah, Schultz is good. He's okay. Bruce Campbell would have totally shown in that.
I mean, Schultz. It was his first movie and his only movie.
Say that if to your point, if it would have been Campbell in that role, and him and Raimi would have fought at that end.
Oh, how awesome!
Oh
would that
my
be?
Gosh,
that's got to be in the Strikers War because I gotta see that short.
On that premise alone, it would drop it a couple numbers to me in a good way,
right? Because
and that's nothing against where they went with it, but I mean, just the idea that Raimi and Bruce could have fought that would have been classic.
And that's a few issues, a little sloppy, but overall, I still think it was pretty good, and I think a 6 is fair.
Okay, well, I'm actually going to go a step higher than you and go 6.5.
Oh, okay.
And so that's funny. You get 5.5 to 6 to 6.5. I agree that this had some issues and other things that made it a little bit lower budget. But I think my biggest problem with it was that they just sort of the tone does switch a little bit too much, where it's really goofy and silly at times, and then it's very serious. Now, you mentioned earlier that you think maybe the Bloodbath script kind of got leaked into that script and stuff too. Mm-hmm. And that's probably true. The stuff that Sheldon sort of wrote, the PTSD and some other stuff, they never get fully explored. So I feel like it sort of ruins the funness of the movie and kind of goes into more stinky aspects of it. And then I think the movie is just, it's fun. It's enjoyable. It's a movie I've seen more than one occasion. I remember watching it. I don't think I had the Blu-ray at the time. I think I had the DVD, and I was watching it in my house, and somebody, I forgot who it was, walked in my room and laughed when the person said, something about crapping, stop crapping around, quit crapping around. Because who says that? Nobody says that. Right. That just doesn't even feel real.
And then, the thing I brought out in our discussion earlier, before we started recording, of regards of, the Hollywood version of what the Manson and the Manson family is. In reality, Manson didn't actually kill anybody or actually do anything. He had his followers do it. So this kind of weird cult isn't really based on Manson
necessarily
so much.
Manson. It was,
he might have got the idea from Manson. But
and then you're wondering, why are these people doing this? It's just because they're weird hippies on drugs? That's
I don't
not
think
really
so. I think
kind
just
of enough.
Fucked up people. I just think they were just fucked up people. I mean, there's the chain guy.
It was the 60s, man.
But clearly they're not trying to hide anything. They've been found in the woods by everybody. So it's not like it's going to go on for very long. Nobody's put much thought into this. Bunch of stupid fucking filthy hippies. Good Lord.
I don't know.
They just seem like very convenient scapegoats.
Right. I mean, they have to have villains, and these are the villains, and these are... And the idea, like, he said Manson family, but I don't think he wanted to do it exactly Manson, because he was probably going, wait, Manson never really did anything, so he's not very a scary villain, you know? It could have been kind of interesting to have Hitler, you know, be the villain or whatever. He wouldn't have been
in 1969. Well, typically, if they had stuck with the Vietnam thing, it would have been the Viet Cong were the enemy. Or it would have been a little bit later on in a more postmodernist idea, later Rambo movies, it's, oh, it was the government who sent me to fight the Viet Cong, double-crossing me. And then it was, oh, it was something else. So they could have gone in that direction, but, you know, the whole point was to do something mashup with the Manson stuff.
A-team mashup with the Manson family.
They even used the same military font for some of the credits. So.
Didn't we notice, like, or you guys notice, like, the MASH, like, helicopter in the beginning? Yeah.
It seemed like that shot. Very MASH-like. That shot of the longer, the double-edged helicopter
I think that was stock footage, and it was shot in California, and they're in the same hills that the MASH ones did, because there's probably a military base there that they could rent helicopters. They could bring helicopters over.
And they just shoot those same scenes. So it's probably stock footage they bought that. Yeah. And you probably got excited. He goes, this looks like MASH. People are going to love this.
And that works. I mean, that's fine. That's not Ed Wood bringing in Buffalo and saying, aha, let's build around this stock footage.
Yeah.
Oh, no, with the elevator, I mean, not the elevator, but the helicopters lowering in. That just reminded me of a completely off guard, off topic, but the helicopters dropping in on in Hot Shots.
Yeah.
And then somebody get that thing out of here because of the model instead of it being the real thing. But I think they were doing that to, I guess, MASH wasn't Vietnam though, was it MASH?
No, Korea? That was Korea.
Yeah, so that was actually a different war.
Yeah, that was a Huey helicopter, not a little bitty one.
And some of the stuff with the outfits and all, it seemed like, were they Marines or were they Army?
Yeah, there was a lot of Army surplus stuff in
there. Yeah, which I'm sure they couldn't find, like, necessarily Marine wear there.
Some of them wasn't wearing necessarily the same type of war gear that they probably should have been all wearing.
Yeah, it was a little messed up. A lot of the equipment
was incongruous, but that's part of the budget.
Yeah, I mean, and that said, I don't know what the dollar budget was on this film, but it's, I mean, they bit off a lot with this film.
I liked the 60s era A&W drive-in place. That looked like it was fun.
Which they probably had in 1985.
They like bought a pile of food, and she's like $1.75. I was like, what? Holy shit.
And they had a lot of the, all through it, they had the product placements of the containers and all. And they looked older. I mean, they looked apart in the boxes, on the counters, in the shed that they blew up where they all shot it up. I mean,
I just couldn't believe. I mean, she got a cheeseburger and fries. He got four dilly dogs.
Six
dilly dogs. And they got a Coke and a 7-Up, and that was $1.75.
I think 72.
It was no Coke. They said they only had root beer.
Yeah. I thought he said beer, and they go, we only have root beer.
Yeah, that was it.
And so he was like, yes, root beer, you know.
$1.72, now you pay that in taxes on the food.
Times three.
Yeah, you pay that just for the taxes or more. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a cute little movie to me. It was fun. It was enjoyable.
There's that word again, cute.
I love that word. I use it all the time. John Ward gets on me about that.
Now, they didn't do anything with the baby. You just see him menacing the baby, but the baby's never brought up again.
It just closes in on it because it shows him, and it's just like zoom.
And it's funny because I hadn't seen this in a long time, so it looked like they were going to completely forget about poor Sally. And you even were like, wait a minute, what about Sally?
They're driving off and it just pans across from all these people. And all of a sudden, there she is.
There she is. Like,
you totally forgot about Sally. Like, really? Like, all of a sudden, he just gives her a hug and brings her in. And I'm like, you asshole.
You forgot about whiskey. You forgot about Sally.
Yeah, you didn't care about any of these people except yourself.
Unfortunately, I think they found whiskey.
Yeah, they found
whiskey. That was sad news.
Stryker was an asshole. Goodness gracious. Anyway.
I would have been out there at night, and I don't care who would have been out there. If my dog was out there, I would have been doing everything I can. Yeah.
Especially if I heard him yelp in pain absolutely, like that. Like, that was
I know, and he's like, oh, I guess he got himself lost.
I love his voice on that.
Until you can't.
It sounded like he fell on a chainsaw, for God's sakes.
I know.
It was awful.
I hated that. Like, and you have to make an actual dog sound like that, and that's terrible. Like, I don't know. What I'm guessing that was a sound of, like,
stock footage.
Sound stock footage. Let's hope like, so. I would not want them torturing that poor dog just to get him to do that. Anyway, well, on that note, we just want to say thank you guys so much for joining us. Thank you, Joe. You'll be back this season. There'll be more.
See, episodes. You were expecting much worse, weren't you?
Well, with me, he doesn't know. With you,
Geek Maggot Bingo, more. Baby.
Yeah, he expects worse.
I don't know. I don't know if one of these times I'm going to walk in, it's going to be like Actia Maximus's child or something. Or
oh, that's coming. I've already warned Moody.
Son of Maximus.
Actium. Maximus. Oh, all right, everybody. Thank you guys for...
part of three, and I've got two of them.
Joining us and...
four souls.
We will be back soon, and it will be Paul's turn.
Woohoo!
And until then, everybody, hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and join us next week for a brand new episode.
See you on the flip side.
Bye.
Bye.
I am talking right now. What do you say, Joe?
I don't say much right now, but I'll say a lot later.
Can you speak louder?
Yeah, sure. Louder, louder, louder. Testing. Even more. Squeak, squeak.